Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Utah records its highest single-day increase in COVID-19 deaths. Frontline healthcare workers become the first residents to receive vaccine doses in the state. Lawmakers plan to give a $1,500 bonus to Utah teachers, but may withhold the money from educators in the Salt Lake City School District. And federal land managers pull the plug on a Utah tar sands lease after the revelation that the applicant was a contractor with the Bureau of Land Management. On the phone for this discussion, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter and assistant editor Sean P. Means. Good morning, Sean. Welcome.
Good morning.
We've also got Tribune Public Lands reporter Brian Maffley. Good morning and welcome to you, Brian.
Yeah, hi there, Roger. Good to see you.
You too. Thanks for being here. And news columnist Robert Gerke is on the line as well. And good morning and welcome to you, Robert.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And of course, we want to hear from our listeners as well. Add your comments or questions about the stories that we're discussing by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. You can also call the number 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Two milestones on the coronavirus front this week. One good, one bad, and Sean Means, maybe let's get the bad news out of the way first. I'm thinking here of some numbers that were reported by the Department of Health yesterday on Thursday. Sort of a bleak picture in terms of fatalities. Can you tell us about that?
Right. Yesterday, Utah Department of Health recorded 30 deaths from the day before. Now, bear in mind, this isn't people who just died yesterday. These are cases that the medical examiner have been, checking on and finally confirmed. And some of them may go back a couple of weeks, but still, 30 reported in a day. That is the most we've had in a single day.
And there's kind of an equation, Sean. I mean, this spreads. The more the virus spreads, you'll see a corresponding uptick in fatalities. A couple of weeks later.
It's considered a lagging indicator. Basically, if you have some sort of outbreak or surge, 10 days later you'll get hospitalizations, and then another week later, maybe more, you'll get an uptick in the fatalities. Mm-hmm. And so this may represent, this 30 on Thursday could represent sort of backwash from the Thanksgiving surge. Which the state has been saying was not as bad as they thought, but it still wasn't great. And this is just an indicator of that.
On that milestone, that tough milestone, here's Dr. Angela Dunn at yesterday's COVID briefing.
This is a tragic reminder that while there is a lot of hope on the horizon with the vaccine, we still have quite a long ways to go, and we need to continue being vigilant to protect individuals against unnecessary illness and death. So that means wearing your mask, limiting your close contacts, and staying home when you're ill.
And Sean, Dr. Dunn, in issuing that warning, is teasing the other half of this, the positive milestone, and that's, of course, the vaccine, the fact that vaccinations have begun here in Utah. Can you tell us how it all began, and then we can talk about the kind of overarching plan for distributing the vaccine, but the first vaccines being issued?
Right. The shipments arrived Monday at LDS Hospital and Utah Valley Hospital down in Provo, LDS Hospital in Salt Lake. And Intermountain said, "Okay, we're going to do this Tuesday, 1 o'clock, LDS Hospital. Bring your TV cameras, and the first frontline healthcare workers will get the first doses." About an hour before that happened, University Hospital tweeted out, "Oh yeah, we're giving them out now." And so University Hospital got to claim the credit of having the first COVID-19 vaccine shots administered in the state of Utah. A frontline nurse by the name of Christy Mulder got that honor. So University Hospital, LDS Hospital, and then other hospitals around the state started on Tuesday. Have been going Wednesday, Thursday. We're already sort of in what's considered the second wave of phase one, because outside the big five hospitals that got the first shipments, more hospitals yesterday and today are getting shipments of the Pfizer drug. And then by next week, the assumption is that the FDA is going to approve the Moderna version of the vaccine, possibly today, and that shipments of the Moderna will start going out early next week, and that will expand even further, and will expand to more areas of the state because the Moderna doesn't have to be stored at the super cold temperatures that the Pfizer drug
right.
does, and that sort of tethers it to those big hospitals. So the Moderna will be going to all corners of Utah and to places that the Pfizer has not been able to get to.
Wow.
And the hope is more gets produced, more gets shipped, more gets sent, and more gets into people's arms.
You know, just before we jump a little bit further into that, in terms of the first people who are receiving these vaccinations, you know, the frontline healthcare workers who are in emergency rooms and so on in the state, what was the general sentiment? I mean, how were they reacting about what this meant to them?
They were thrilled. I mean, you know, that phrase "light at the end of the tunnel" keeps popping up all the time, and which it is, but it's also a reminder that we're still in the tunnel. But they talk about it in terms of this is going to keep them safe while they work with COVID patients. This is going to keep their family safe, their coworkers safe, keep themselves safe, and it's very symbolic of, you know, the hope that, you know, we are going to, that the corner is being turned on this, and that we are reaching a point where, as more people get the vaccine, as more people, you know, are develop immunity to the virus.
Yeah.
We will eventually, and eventually is the important word here, be able to get back to what we used to call a normal life.
Again, healthcare workers, those on the front lines, first, they are starting this off. The state is tracking how many people are getting vaccinated. And as of yesterday, we had hit 407, I believe, vaccinations
right.
administered. Though it dawns on me that's the first dose of a two-shot vaccine. This requires two shots, right?
Yeah, and that's the key point. That's the key here is that these people who got the first dose, they're going to have to rely on the state and the hospitals and the federal government making sure that shipments arrive 3 weeks from now so that they can get the second dose. So that they need to maintain that constant, you know, that constant stream of vaccines coming in so that they can handle both doses.
I guess at some point we can, you know, we'll be able to divide by two on the state's you know, coronavirus dashboard, and we'll see how many people have been vaccinated. But anyway, Sean, I wanted to talk more broadly about the vaccine rollout plan, and maybe to get things going on that front, we can do just a tiny bit of fact checking or rumor checking. In a story that you published this morning, you write about a rumor that elected officials and lawmakers, you know, state leaders were going to kind of butt in line to get their vaccine
yeah.
earlier than others. Can you just talk about that rumor and where it came from?
Yeah, well, I mean, the source of this particular rumor, according to my colleague Brian Schott, was a Facebook post by Jim DeBacchus, former state senator. It's a rumor that always pops up in situations like this where there's some sort of crisis
right.
that the rich and well-connected are going to get it before you do. And that's what the Facebook post. And the other part about the Facebook post that was interesting was the immediate blowback. Spencer Cox wrote back to say, Jim, I love you. Jimmy, I love you all my heart, but what the hell are you doing?
Right.
And sort of demanding that DeBacchus take the Facebook post down because he was saying that what DeBacchus was saying was just not true. Now, the fact check that we've done is we talked to people from the major hospital groups in Utah, and they are under very strict guidelines from the CDC as to who gets the vaccine in the first round, in the first phase. And the first phase is frontline healthcare workers, not doctors, nurses, people who work in the ERs, like the janitors, you know, the cleanup crew. If you're in that frontline working directly with COVID patients, you're supposed to be getting that vaccine first.
Hmm.
Now, to keep track of that, they have monitoring. They have like, you know, you have to have your employee ID number registered when you get your shot. The hospitals have to keep, you know, very good records. For the simple reason that if they don't, the CDC won't give them the next batch, and they don't want to mess that up. So they are being very strict about making sure, nobody's going to jump the queue.
Okay. And remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to @KCPW. But so, quote unquote, cutting in line, Sean, that's not happening, at least not in this first round, as you described.
Right.
Maybe I'll bring in the news columnist, Robert Gerke. Robert, anything to say on this front? And I do want to get to the full, rollout of vaccines, Sean, and when the general public might get it. But Robert Gerke on the sort of rumor mill, I guess. Anything to say?
The rumor mill is the rumor mill. We can't really do anything about that except tell people, what we're being told, and we can't observe every person who's getting it. So, people are going to believe what they're going to believe, I suppose. I think so far the rollout has gone reasonably well, and there is some question about the state moved teachers into sort of the second phase of people who are going to get it. And there's some controversy over that, whether teachers should be getting it ahead of, say, the elderly, who are making up the majority of the deaths related to COVID. And there's some legitimate questions there. I think given the scarcity of the doses we've got to be smart about how we get them out. We've got to make sure there aren't, nothing hampers the distribution and the logistics of it. And so far, so good. And we're hoping, we saw the Moderna vaccine is looking like it's going to be on its way shortly, and that should accelerate things significantly.
Hey, Robert, just taking a step back, on the fact that this is, throughout this pandemic, it's been hard not to think about how recognizably historic the period of time that we're living through is, the enormous global impact and 1.7 million deaths worldwide, and here in the United States, 310,000 deaths. And now we're beginning that slow process towards coming out on the other side, though there is still a gauntlet to get through with that. Just on the sort of historic nature of the fact that people are beginning to receive vaccines, what does that mean to you?
Well, this is what we've been hanging on to for months at this point, right? It's been, and the fact that it's been 9 months, 10 months, as opposed to 2-3 years, is a remarkable achievement. I called it in one of my earlier columns, perhaps the most significant scientific achievement in our lifetime, certainly. Mm-hmm. It's remarkable, and it's going to revolutionize the way we do vaccines in the future. It's going to take some time to get everybody the doses we need, as you note. And so we've got several months of pain ahead of us. But, this is that glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel. And it's the hope that we can have a rebirth in 2021 and get lives back to somewhat normal. It's revolutionary. So, you can't overstate the importance of this. Everything we've gone through in 2020 was kind of leading up to this point, I think. And we've tried to control the damage that has been done, economic damage, but also certainly the loss of lives is paramount. And we've done it with an aim to getting to the point where we can start vaccinating people and getting to some level of immunity that will allow us to return to normal. So, it's a landmark achievement. And in terms of, again, the history of science ranks up there certainly as one of the most remarkable achievements in our lifetimes.
Yeah. Sean P. Means, Robert Gerke points out of course we've got a waiting period ahead of us, and that inevitably means, more infections, more hospitalizations, more deaths while we wait. But while we wait, what is the rollout plan? What happens next with the vaccine, and then when does, everybody get it?
Right. Well, right now we're in phase one, and we're in what they call the first wave of phase one, which is the frontline healthcare workers. After that, it's staff and residents of long-term care facilities, nursing homes, and so on. Because those are people who are also in the thick of it as far as the spread of the COVID. After that, it's healthcare workers who don't work in hospitals, like clinicians and so on. Then it's teachers. They got bumped up a few notches on the ladder.
Yeah.
And then other first responders, firefighters, cops, corrections officers, and so on. That's phase one, and that is the estimate in the state is 267,000 people would fit in those groups. Now, it's not guaranteed that each of them is going to take it because it's not take the vaccine because it's not required. There's no job requirement saying you take this or you lose your job or anything like that. But the impetus is it would be common sense to do so. So that will get us through end of January, early February. Phase two starts up, and there's a bunch of groups that would fit into phase two. Over 65, people with comorbidities, so you know other underlying health factors, tribal communities, minority and ethnic communities, prisoners, homeless, and people experiencing homelessness, all fit, and essential workers. And essential workers is broadly defined as being, you know, people who can't stay and work at their laptops
right.
at home. People who have to actually go out and work in the public, restaurant workers, grocery workers, food prep workers, and so on. Now, the question of within that bunch, who goes first, is still being determined by the health department, and they are you know poring over all the actuary tables and everything else to try to figure out who goes first, and they are trying and they are working very hard to make that process as unpolitical as possible, but there's always the worry that somebody's going to stick their hand in. So those groups, that's the second wave, and that'll get us from March through about June. Unless we get lucky and there's more shipments faster than we anticipated, we've heard about how the pharmacists figured out that you could squeeze a sixth dose out of a five dose vial,
right.
and that obviously that means one more person getting vaccinated, and you know there's 195 vials in every one of those boxes that get shipped, so you know it will add up. So if things go faster, great. And then after, you know, once wave two or the phase two is done, then phase three, and that's everybody. That's you. That's me. That's all of us working at the laptops.
Yeah.
That also includes, and I asked her about this today, the other day. Dr. Angela Dunn, the state epidemiologist, she says, I'm in the third phase. Zoom calls are my life. I'm fine. She's in a low risk group. She's young and healthy. She works from home, so even the person who knows more about the vaccine and about the COVID-19 than anybody else in the state is at the back of the line.
Thank you, Sean, very much for that. And you know, in terms of the timing on this, I remember that state leaders said that come June or July is when that back of the line group of vaccinations would happen.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about this, Sean. I remember seeing, I swear I saw a photo of Dr. Angela Dunn getting a vaccination, or maybe she was just there.
She was posing with the nurses who got it, but she herself did not.
Okay, thank you so much for clarifying on that. You know what, this is obviously a story that we will return to, and we do need to head to our first break in the show, but Sean P. Means, thank you for bringing us up to date on this, and it's obviously a time for hope, but not necessarily for complacency when it comes to where we are. In this vaccination process. We're going to take a break here on Behind the Headlines. And when we come back, a story about teacher bonuses. And then we'll also we'll revisit a story that is about tar sands that has changed pretty dramatically since last Friday. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Sean P. Means and Brian Maffley, as well as news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup. You can call us to join this conversation. The number to call is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us, our handle being at KCPW. Robert Gierke, news columnist, I'm going to go to you. You wrote some commentary this week responding to news about money for Utah educators. Let's first lay out what the news was. Lawmakers announced that they're planning on giving teachers bonuses, but not necessarily all teachers. Where did the idea of giving out bonuses come from, and how is that budgeted?
Yeah, so the executive appropriations, the legislature's top budget committee, met this week, and they proposed or revealed, I guess, a $400 million bump for public education, which is a tremendous amount of money, given, you know, they said it was a record amount of new money for public education,
yeah.
Which is extraordinary given the economic circumstances we're in. And part of that was $121 million that was going to go directly to teachers, $1,500 for licensed teachers, $1,000 per person for staff. And the idea being it's a sign of gratitude or thanks for the teachers, the work the teachers have done during the course of the pandemic. But then Speaker Brad Wilson proposed intent language, which is just guiding language to the program, that said it would not be given to teachers who work in districts that are not offering in-person classes. And that is really just Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City is the only one that doesn't have the option of doing in-person classes. So specifically excluding Salt Lake City from this bonus, you know, if they want the bonus, then the district needs to get back to school by the time the legislature convenes a month from now. So and that seems unlikely, but you know, there were plans in Salt Lake District to start phasing in-person classes again after the first of the year, but not on a time frame that would satisfy the speaker. Obviously, the education community, the Salt Lake Teachers Association, thought that this was extortion. They thought it was, you know, they didn't make the decision to not be in school. It was made by the elected board of the district, and it seemed they felt like they were being coerced by Speaker Wilson, who was trying to advance, as they put it, a political agenda of putting teachers back in the classroom. Now, this is also comes on the backdrop of reporting by Heather May in the Salt Lake Tribune that there's been a sharp spike in the number of students who are failing classes in Salt Lake District. The online education component isn't working as well as in-person classes, and I don't think anybody's really surprised by that, frankly. But there was a sixfold increase in the number of students who have failed a class in the first quarter of the year. And, also a sharp increase in the number of students who are failing all of their classes, who have basically just, you know, gone away. So it should be noted, though, that Granite District is facing a similar spike. There are about a fivefold increase. And so, you know, online education has been challenging. And Speaker Wilson believes, as he said in a statement he released yesterday, that students need to be back in the classroom. It's doing what's right for the students, and he's not going to apologize for doing that.
It's interesting. I mean, this is, as you said, this is sort of dangling a carrot. And then, Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall referred to this as punitive for these teachers who, again, right, they didn't choose for this to happen. But also, isn't the decision, you know, whether to bring kids back or not, I mean, it's not a decision that's just about schools and kids. It's about the spread of the virus more generally, and then as a result, other things, hospitalizations, deaths. I guess is that calculus being thought of?
Well, yeah. So I mean, we've got a little bit better data now than we had back in August and July when districts were making these decisions. And one of the data points that I think is interesting is that the HERO Project at the University of Utah looked at the infection rates for students who were in person versus online, and maybe this seems like common sense to everybody, but when, you know, the argument has been made that schools are no more or less risky than what students are doing on their own. And it found that that's simply not the case, that there's a 40 high school students in particular, 40% more likely to be infected with the virus when they're in person classes. And so that compared the Salt Lake District to the surrounding districts, and yeah, the 40% more likely to get infected. And so there, and then, you know, there is pretty clear and compelling evidence, I think, that the spike that we experienced in September and October, and that is resulting in these deaths now, was driven in no small part by students returning to school, both public school and college students. And so, you know, now the flip side of that, also the same data from the HERO Project found that there is that elementary and middle school students are no more likely to get the virus in school versus online. So, you know, we have better data now, and these decisions can be tailored a little bit more surgically, I think. But at the same time, we're, you know, back in August, if you think about it, we were having about 100, 150 cases a day. Now we're having 10 times that, 20 times that in some instances. And so we've got to, you know, it's not safer now to be sending kids back to school. So there's got to be some thought put into it in terms of how we can do that. I think, you know, most people would agree that if students can be in school safely, they should be in school safely. And so the question is, can they be in school safely? That's the important modifier on that. And how do we go about making it as safe as possible?
Well, and lawmakers like the House Speaker think they know better than the school district does about what the right thing to do here is in terms of what's safe and correct. I mean, obviously, we know that students are suffering and that in-person learning is ideal. But again, yeah, that safely thing, not just necessarily for the students themselves, but for the community at large, I think is the point that I was trying to make. Where does this go, Robert? This is a bonus that might be awarded, with the starter at the close of the legislative session. How does that happen? How does that approval process happen?
Yeah, if I could just sort of elaborate on that last point you made.
Sure.
I mean, these decisions are made by elected school boards, elected by the local parents, the local teachers, mostly the parents, frankly, and they're accountable to them. And the Republican Party line for years and years and years has been that the government that governs closest to the people governs best, right? And so this is an attempt by the legislature, which is not accountable to these parents, to force its will on the school district. So now moving on, where does it go from here? This is a recommendation from the Budget Committee. It is made up of leadership from both the Senate and the House, so they have a lot of clout on what ends up in the budget. And this is almost certain to end up in the budget, which will be, you know, they'll adopt a base budget at the beginning of the legislative session when they convene. I believe it's January 19th, if I remember right, just after MLK Day. So that's sort of the next step in this. And, you know, I guess it remains to be seen. There could be political pressure brought by the parents and the teachers in Salt Lake District. But as we've seen in the past, the legislature doesn't really have any qualms about sticking it to Salt Lake when push comes to shove. So I would anticipate that we'll see this advance next month.
Just quickly, Robert, you had a suggestion that maybe, you know, the whole idea of teacher bonuses should be scrapped altogether. I mean, obviously, we want to fund education appropriately, but you were thinking, in your column at least, you suggested that maybe this money could be better spent in other ways to deal with the pandemic.
Well, I mean, I had two ideas. I mean, one is, if we're giving this to teachers who are, you know, putting their lives on the line by teaching in-person classes, then call it hazard pay and give it to the teachers who are teaching in person. That's a little bit more equitable, and there are a lot of, but it also sort of, I think, misses the point that teachers who are teaching online are still teaching and still going to extraordinary lengths to make sure students learn. The other thing I thought was, you know, we've got teachers deserve our respect and deserve better pay. But they also are working, and a lot of people in our community are not. The people in restaurants and bars and gyms and theaters who are bearing the brunt of the economic hardship of this pandemic and the response and making these sacrifices for the betterment, for the safety of our community, ideally so we can put students in classrooms safely. You know, and it seems like if we have this much money to spend, some of that money could be good. could go to alleviate some of the hardship that they're experiencing, you know, and some assistance to these businesses and assistance to the workers who are either furloughed or out of a job or have seen their wages significantly reduced and are having a hard time making ends meet. Because, you know, we've talked about this before on the show. We have a looming crisis with evictions and housing and rent and food and hunger and all of these things that are being borne disproportionately, I think, by the people who are making the sacrifices to try to keep us safe.
All right. Robert Gerke, thank you again for covering this for us. And a reminder to listeners that you're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. And you can join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255. I want to now bring in public lands reporter Brian Maffley for the follow-up to a story that we covered last week on this show. Last Friday, Brian, you and I talked about some last-minute public lands leasing being done by the Bureau of Land Management in the waning days of the Trump administration. And this was for tar sands development near Tavernal. That story has changed pretty dramatically. In fact, the deal is off. Why is that the case, Brian?
Yeah, there's some interesting backstory has emerged in that. Since we last spoke, Roger.
Yep.
So, just going to summarize, the BLM kind of at the very end of the Trump administration has brought out a proposal to lease 2,100 acres for tar sands development in what's called Asphalt Ridge, and it was kind of a surprise because tar sands has not really panned out in Utah despite an enormous amount of resource here. It's just really hard to extract, and it's got a pretty big environmental footprint when you do develop it, because it involves strip mining and solvents and industrial processes. So what happened here was the new state director of the BLM, Greg Sheehan, who's not a BLM guy, but a wildlife guy from the state of Utah, learned that the applicant for this project was someone who worked for the BLM. And apparently he felt that didn't look very good and has now put a pause on this whole proposal while they investigate whether that's appropriate or not. So in a sense, this is kind of a story of, maybe the BLM acting, one hand not talking to the other during the more than 10 years that this proposal was in development.
I'm going to read a piece of, the idea here is that someone who was a contractor with Bureau of Land Management was the person who was who was trying to get these leases. And I'm going to read a piece of your story here, and feel free to comment on this or not, Brian, but here it is, a couple of paragraphs worth of text, so just bear with me. The BLM announced Friday it was suspending the analysis and would no longer accept public comment. That announcement came the day after the Salt Lake Tribune contacted the BLM with questions about the appropriateness of leasing publicly owned hydrocarbons to someone who works in the very office that oversees mineral leases. The agency's explanations did not get into specifics, but it is clear officials now have concerns about how Jones's arrangement with the BLM looks. And then your article goes on to talk about Greg Sheehan, as you said, the new state director for the BLM. And it reads that Sheehan, a former state wildlife official new to the BLM, did not know about Jones's dual employment before the Tribune's inquiry. Out of all of that, I guess a simple question that I would ask and I've got to ask, actually, is from where you sit, would this tar sands lease to a BLM contractor have gone forward, Brian, if you simply hadn't asked that question?
Well, I think it might have. I don't know. It seems kind of strange that the BLM leadership wouldn't have known that the person who was seeking these leases was one of their own employees. And it also seems kind of odd that wasn't disclosed in any of the environmental disclosure documents. Under the National Environmental Policy Act, you're to do these assessments of the impacts. And it just seems like, that's a pretty basic piece of information that was not disclosed. How I figured it out was it identified the applicant for this project as a company called Jones Lease Service, which is, very generic name, never heard of them. It turns out they're a little company based here in Utah, and I looked up their principal, and it's a gentleman named Vern Jones. And the name was sort of familiar to me because Vern was also the one who bought almost all the leases that sold at the last oil and gas auction for Utah a couple weeks ago. He bought about 4,200 acres for the minimum $2 an acre bid. And I'm like, okay, the name was interesting. I discussed it with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance attorneys I know who are also familiar with Vern Jones and had actually raised these concerns over 10 years ago and about the BLM doing business like this with one of its own employees, although he's a contract employee, not a full-timer. That turns out to be an important distinction. So Sua's issues didn't even have anything to do with the tar sands leases. It had to do with leases elsewhere in the state. So they had, filed formal complaints with the BLM asking them to take a look at the legality of someone like Vern Jones buying leases for himself or for his clients. Turns out his company, Jones Lease Service, is in the business of connecting oil and gas developers with federal leases. So he's acting on behalf of industry. But still, it just looks kind of odd whether Jones is buying these leases for himself or for clients. It just doesn't look right that he's also an employee of the BLM whose job overlaps with this very part of BLM's programs. It's an interesting situation. I think for the other part of this that I think it's interesting is why is the BLM even contemplating offering these tar sands leases? They've spent over $250,000 doing the environmental analysis on these leases. In this area, Asphalt Ridge, is already completely under lease by the state of Utah. The State Trust Lands Administration owns most of those tar sands deposits. And it, 12, 15, 16,000 acres, I can't remember the number, is already under lease. So what difference does it make if the BLM, makes a couple thousand more acres available for tar sands development? It's not going to make that big of a difference in this resource ever getting developed. Okay. If it's going to get developed, it's going to happen on those state leases. And there's a number of companies that have already been trying and failing to produce oil from those resources in an economical way. I mean, they keep trying and they keep getting investors to fund their efforts, but we still haven't seen any significant production of oil from Asphalt Ridge, and we may never.
Brian, just quickly, and I'm sorry that I'm going to have to cut us a little bit short on this one, but you reached out to the principal of this company, who is also the contract employee at BLM, Jones himself. What did he have to say about this particular lease? And then I guess another question that I have, and both of these I'll have you answer quickly, is are other leases of his now in question or under investigation by BLM?
Yeah, I don't know. The BLM isn't really speaking to us on the record about this, so it's hard to know. All they're saying is they're looking into the tar sands lease to see if there's any inappropriate conflicts of interest occurred there. But I would think that the same issues would arise with all the other, the conventional oil and gas leases that Jones has been involved in as well.
And what does he say?
But yeah, when we contacted Jones, he didn't want to talk to us.
Okay. As I said, there's a fair amount, more that I'd like to dig into on this, but we have other news to get to. Anyway, Brian, this particular lease is not happening. There was, under the Trump administration, this energy dominance policy. We talked a little bit about this last week.
Yeah.
You've been taking a deeper look at what that policy amounted to. And so just because I know that it's something that you're covering coming up, what did that what did the energy dominance policy amount to, Brian Maffley?
Yeah, thanks, Roger. This is we're going to be doing an in-depth look at how Trump's energy dominance agenda played out in Utah this weekend. And, you know, we looked at all the data. It didn't really lead to a great deal of energy development in Utah. Elsewhere, especially in New Mexico, under the Trump administration, energy development took off. But Utah, it went the other direction. There was a lot of leasing going on, but was there more development? No. Was there more oil and gas production? No. It actually is off significantly from the time when Obama was president, when supposedly it was much harder to do oil and gas development in the West. But it turned out that there are economic forces at play that just make Utah a less attractive place to do oil and gas development compared with, say, you know, Wyoming and New Mexico.
Brian, just with that, I'm sorry, we're going to have to, you go from that policy to the kind of embodiment of the difference between energy dominance and what the Biden administration is expected to do. You've got his interior pick,
yeah.
Pick for Interior Secretary, New Mexico, U.S. Representative Deb Haaland, who would also be the first Native American cabinet secretary in U.S. history. Whether confirmation happens is another question that is yet to be determined, but we will see on that. And for the moment, we'll have to leave it there. Brian Maffley is public lands reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for covering all of this for us, Brian.
You bet. Thank you, Roger.
We're going to head to another quick break in the show. And when we come back, we'll try and squeeze in a story about the Sundance Film Festival before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Mm-hmm. Featuring reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune, I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by the Tribune's Brian Maffley, Sean P. Means, and Robert Gerke. And you can weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255. Or again, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. As usual, I had intended more time for a story that will get short shrift. But Sean P. Means, you are a veteran Sundance Film Festival reporter. And this year, the festival, I imagine for the first time ever, is going to be largely, you know, digital, largely online. And I guess I'll just have you lay this out, you know, for us, what the plans for Sundance are in the remaining 2.5 minutes that we have before we go to our underplayed stories of the week. So how will Sundance happen this year, Sean?
You're right. Mostly it will be on the Internet. They have worked out a way to create. They've created a web portal where they can stream movies online. It won't be like Netflix where you can just, you know, watch any movie anytime. They're going to set up specific viewing times for the first screenings for each of the films they've chosen for the festival. They're trying to recreate the festival experience as much as they can on the website. You watch the movie at a set time. There's the Q&A afterwards. And you get to sort of have at least a taste of the regular Sundance experience. They've picked 72 films for the slate, which is smaller than usual because usually it's like 120. They are only doing 7 days. It's from January 28th to February 3rd, and they are. They've truncated the program somewhat. They're still doing the New Frontier segment, but also as an online streaming thing. They have picked 30 locations around the country where they're going to try to have live in-person events. Mm. One of those is the Ray Theater in Park City, which is one of the normal Sundance venues. they will try to do it with, you know, staggered seating and everybody masked up and everything. But in each city, it's going to be very dependent on what the local regulations are regarding COVID. If you can do it, if they can do it in Brooklyn or do it in Los, they're going to do like a drive-in at the Rose Bowl parking lot, which I think is pretty cool. But in each case, it's going to be dependent on what you can do with, you know, regarding the COVID. Yep. But the slate they've picked looks really fascinating. There's a lot of cool stuff on here. I think the one I'm looking forward to most is a documentary directed by Amir Robinson, better known as Questlove, mm-hmm. From The Roots.
Yeah.
It's about a famous but forgotten Harlem Cultural Festival, which was a whole bunch of bands and acts, Sly and the Family Stone and the Fifth Dimension and Gladys Knight and the Pips and so on. And there's footage that's been lost for decades that they've found, and they put it together into this documentary. So that's one that is going to be on the opening night, and it looks like it's going to be really exciting.
Very cool.
But it's still going to be Sundance. That's the cool part.
Can I ask just quickly before we head to our underplayed stories? You know, you've been covering this festival for quite a long time, and maybe you can tell us how many years it was exactly, or it has been. But can I just ask for your feelings on what's happening this year? How do you feel about the fact that it is largely online? I guess, does it make it easier for the reporter?
I'm sort of hoping to just sort of hunker in and not have to worry about standing in line and getting my feet in the snow, and still be able to watch a lot of great movies. So there's that. We're going to miss the experience of an audience together discovering a new thing, discovering some new talent or some great film. But I think we'll get a taste of that still online, where we're at least. We'll all be together separately, as has been the case with so many other things in the last year.
Yeah,
and we'll do that, and then we'll just look forward to 2022 when we're all able to go back together and just have a rockin' show in Park City in 2022.
John P. Means covers a lot of things for the Salt Lake Tribune. We didn't even talk about the fact that Robert Redford, founder of the festival, is selling the Sundance Resort. I will direct people to read more at sltrib.com. Thank you for your truncated look at the Sundance Film Festival. With that, we will turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist, what's your pick?
I'm going to do a little self-promotion here. Earlier this week, I did a piece about Jill Holker, who is a mother of three and a nurse at Utah Valley Regional Medical Center, who spent most of the year caring for COVID patients. She contracted the disease, has been intubated and on a life support machine, has been flown to Gainesville, Florida, for the potential for a double lung transplant. And so you can read the story there, and there's also a GoFundMe page to raise some money for the hospital bills and to help support her children while she's incapacitated.
Wow, that's a tough story, and thanks for your coverage, Robert Gerke, and your pick for underplayed story. Brian Maffley, we will turn to you for your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I really loved Sean's story about Sundance Ski Resort being sold. It was one of Robert Redford's signature properties here in Utah, and a beloved place to ski, and it hopefully will stay that way. And thanks, Sean, for doing that story.
All right. Brian Maffley picks a fellow reporter here on the show's story, and we will turn to Sean P. Means. We'll go back to you for your pick for underplayed story.
You know, in all the talk of all the COVID-19 stuff happening this week, Governor Gary Herbert went and did a couple things. He announced that they were going to relax the school guidelines for dealing with COVID-19, including saying that even if you get if you're a student and you get exposed to another student who has COVID, you don't necessarily have to quarantine. If you're both masked up, you might be able to. The kid might still be able to stay in school.
Right.
And which, again, just applies more pressure to the Salt Lake School District regarding what we were talking about earlier about online classes. And at the same time, he also announced that the 10 p.m. Alcohol curfew was being lifted. So you can read all about that. Kathy Stevenson wrote about the alcohol curfew. Bethany Rogers and Aaron Alberti wrote about the school guidelines, all of it in the Tribune.
Awesome. SLTrib.com. For my part, I'm going to go with an astronomical conjunction that is happening in the days ahead. The the planets Jupiter and Saturn are going to appear closer than they've appeared in our nighttime sky than they have in the past 400 years. And, you know, in actuality, they'll be millions and millions of miles apart from each other, but they will look amazingly close. And it all kind of gets, you know, they get to their closest on December 21st, the winter solstice. Most of the stories that you've been hearing about on this show, you can hear, you can find at sltrib.com. And with that, I will say Brian Maffley, Sean P. Means, Robert Gerke, all with that paper. Thanks very much for joining me on the program today.
Thanks, Roger.
Bye.
Yep.
Thanks, Roger. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That does it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, which is a listener-supported, entirely independent local public radio resource. A quick note that next Friday is Christmas, and so we won't have a show. The week after that is New Year's Day, and we will have a special Utah News Year in Review, though not very much interesting happened in 2020, so why bother? Find podcasts at kcpw.org or however you get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough, wishing you a lovely holiday. Thanks again for tuning in. And join us again soon.